I'm Alvin Pitcher. I'm an ex-University of Chicago Divinity School professor, and I am now very much engaged in helping our church come to life, as some of you know from our series on trying to become the body of Christ in many ways. And I'm also practically full-time at Operation Push, which is Jesse Jackson's operation in Chicago, although he's left it for the most part for the Rainbow Coalition. I'm not really intending to deal with the issue of pacifism today, although what I say will be very much related to pacifism. I used to do a great deal with pacifists, arguing against their position many years ago, and the dialogue was chiefly concerned with their effort to find a principle of life which you could universalize or absolutize, like don't lie or never kill. And I had real problems with that, particularly in the World War, when I remember French people saying they had hidden Jews, and the Gestapo came to ask them if they had any Jews in their home. And they said no. They said no. And then I remember in the same context when Bonhoeffer decided he had to participate in a plot to kill Hitler. I have never been able to find a principle of acting that is universal, that is some form of action. So I have problems with the pacifist, but I consider myself a very nonviolent person. My nonviolence grows out of my experience and my understanding of it. I began back in the 60s with Jesse Jackson, who was a student of mine, and we started his organization together. But I never will forget going to visit the alderman of the 4th Ward, and before we went he said, now let's assume that this alderman, who was one of the famous silent black aldermen in Chicago tied to the Daily Machine, let's assume that this alderman is like us, that he is a human being, that he has all kinds of interests and motives, that he's tied into a political situation in the city, which makes it very difficult for him to act the way he wants to. But if he's going to get the kind of financial support that permits him to be the alderman, he's going to have to do what Daley said. So let's go in with that assumption. Let's not go in attacking him for being undermining the black cause by relating to the Daily Machine and doing what the mayor wants. Let's just go in. And we had a wonderful conversation. There was no defensiveness. We didn't create a defensive situation, which he had to apologize. And Jesse always said that when the situation changes, the black alderman would change. And sure enough, Alderman Metcalf, who also became a congressperson, he shifted his position and broke with the machine eventually, after the black community developed enough resources so they could provide him with some financial support. He broke. Well, this is a general way, and sometimes one doesn't know whether it's a calculated way or whether it's a being way. And I'm trying to talk today about a being way. I also had a lot of experience with Martin Luther King's Northern Crusade. Actually, I was the administrative assistant for the Chicago leader of the Freedom Movement when King came. So I was very much a part, both at the level of policy and administration of King's Northern Crusade. So I participated in the formulation of the program. And I never will forget the attempt to formulate a program which would raise the issue about housing in Chicago. And it was that we should begin to visit some of the white neighborhoods, and we should begin to send people in black couples and white couples, to see what would happen in real estate agencies. And of course, every time a black person went, they would neither show, rent, or sell. Every time the white person went, they were open to renting, showing, and selling. But the whole point of the campaign was to educate people as to the fact that there was a law which said that real estate agents had to show, rent, and sell to anybody, regardless of their national origin or of their ethnic background. And the point of the campaign was to educate. It wasn't to attack the real estate agents as agents. It was simply to call attention to the fact that this behavior was contrary to the law. Well, many things happened during that. And now I'm back in Operation Push, and I've developed an analysis in order to live in the situation that I work in. So this analysis is an attempt to deal with what I call violent people. I'm trying to think of the human situation and the characteristics of some people. And my conclusion is there are some people who are just violent, and they're in high positions. But their whole way of looking at life is what I call a violent way. And there are other people who are nonviolent. And I can go through the relations I have in Operation Push and locate these people in terms of these categories. And the whole approach is quite different. So I now have then this analysis, which I presented to a group of ministers and staff at Push, on violent, what I call a violent approach and a nonviolent approach. For this conversation, I call it a violent way of being and a nonviolent way of being. The violent person, or the violent approach, from the very beginning, before there is communication, assumes that the other has bad motives. That is to say, one assumes that the other is not going to cooperate, that the other will be using one, that the other will have his or her own purposes and will have no interest in your purposes or your way of looking at things. One assumes that the other is at heart evil. Evil. Now, in the nonviolent approach, one assumes from the very beginning that the other one is not wholly evil. And one knows, at least I think one knows, if one looks at himself, that he or she is not, at least as I look at myself, I'm not just a pure either way. I'm a very much mixed person with all kinds of motives and all kinds of feelings and all kinds of reactions. And so I assume, and it's very interesting how this works out, I assume from the very beginning that the other person is not wholly evil. I assume that what other people say about most people is not wholly true, and particularly if they are talking about the evilness of the other person. I assume that what other people say about other people's actions, particularly if they're talking about the action being questionable, is not wholly true, that it's a mixture of things. So it's assuming that mixture, I am prepared to accept the other person in a human relationship for what emerges out of the situation, and I tend to negate what other people say about the past and see for myself. One assumes in the violent approach that confrontation will be necessary. The only way to achieve desirable results is to threaten to destroy the other. That is to say, you've got to take away something very important of the other person before the other person will even think about your position or what you think is good or what you think needs to be done. Now, in the nonviolent approach, one begins by appealing to the better self of the other, to his interest in justice and fairness, or to his or her concern for life in general. That is, one begins by assuming that there is a humanity in everybody and that that can be appealed to, and that if one doesn't go in swinging and assuming that the other one is evil, that some of that good will emerge. In the first case, that is the violent approach, one assumes that the chief or only strong motive to which one can appeal is that of fear. You can't assume that one loves. In the nonviolent approach, one assumes that while love as a motive may be warped or covered over, down deep it exists. People care at the heart of their being if they are freed from all kinds of things, compulsions and anxieties. This approach, of course, would assume that if you took away the American bases which surround Russia, that you'd get a different kind of behavior. That is to say that it assumes that if you set up certain conditions, the good or a caring or a concern or a less confrontational situation will develop. So that on the one side you have fear, and the other side you have care. You assume that people care about each other, about life, about things in general. And in many ways, they care as much as you do, and maybe more than you do. But at least there's some possibility. In a violent approach, one assumes that destructive action, so-called evil, must be responded to by an equal or stronger destructive or forceful action. The past becomes the basis for the action. What somebody did to you, you must do to them. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Now, in the nonviolent approach, one assumes that destructive action must be absorbed. That any violence or any distrust or any effort to undermine one must be absorbed and not responded to in kind. One tries to overcome the past, to forgive, to start over again. The evil is absorbed and one is oriented toward the future. Just before I left, one of the persons with whom I'm working very closely, a businessman, said to me, "Well, your colleague told me not to talk to you." This also is a colleague who got the officer of her, she has a particular corporation that's over against Push that she is the executive director for. She got the chairman of her board to call an executive in the Ford Motor Company to tell that executive that Ford should no longer deal with the chairman of our negotiating, a minister is the chairman of our negotiating committee, with whom I work very closely. I'm assistant to the president for economic development at Push, and so I have to work with all of these negotiating teams, and I help pick the people and work with the people, and we've been working with Ford for a long time to try to get some sort of arrangement with them where they'll make opportunities for black people more available. And they'll purchase more from black companies, they'll set up black companies, they'll do something to increase the economic life of the black community, which is very, very minimal. At any rate, this person, I'm sure, I heard the conversation, so I know the call was made. Ford reported to us the conversation, so we know twice that it was made. And of course it was an effort to undermine me. I mean, I'm the one most associated in Push right now with the negotiations with the Ford Motor Company. And so what do I do in relation? What a violent way would be to attempt to undermine her, to begin to spread all these rumors, and I could spread a lot of rumors about her. All the other way is to love her. So the next day, I was Xeroxing some stuff that I thought she wanted, and I Xeroxed a copy of it for her and took it into her. And in every way possible, I just wrote her a letter, and I signed it, Love, Al. Now, I don't know what in me allows me to do that. I don't have any special nonviolent gifts. It's not an intellectual thing, but it's something has happened in my being which allows me to respond. I mean, my whole life. And I must admit, I thought about resigning after a couple of these things happened. And there are other people who've undermined some of the things I've been doing there too. Now, this minister with whom I worked before is a very non-violent person. He believes, and they say we're unrealistic, that we can sit down with an official of the Ford Motor Company and negotiate in good faith a program, and that's what we've been doing, in a kind of non-confrontational style. Well, about, I'd say, 6 or 8 people who've been related to this process think we're unrealistic. We are being taken for a ride. We're dealing with the vice president who's in charge of labor negotiations, and he's a past master. We don't have enough information. We're not skilled enough. And one of the favorite things about the violent approach is to think that all other people are stupid or idiots. I've heard more language in the last 2 years about idiots and stupidity, and I'm considered stupid. No, I don't have any knowledge or experience, although I spent the first 5 years in every negotiation that Jesse Jackson had with corporate America. There's a strong tendency to assume one has all the answers, all the truth, and the other people are stupid idiots. And I don't know whether you've experienced this, but there are just some people who think this way. And it's a matter of degree. I'm not suggesting that everybody is on the same, there's a continuum of this. And then on the other side, there is, on the nonviolent side, one trusts everyone. Well, no, I'll take this truth matter. It assumes that truth is one in a process of listening to others, and to one has extended communication, that one doesn't have all the truth. One starts with the ambiguities of life, that one is a mixture of truth and untruth, of virtue and of vice. And you seek to set up conditions both for yourself and others where your lack of knowledge will be mitigated, and where you will be questioned about your virtue, and you won't have such an easy notion of your own virtue because you have listened to others talk about how they perceive what you do. I missed one point here. One distrusts everybody from the beginning in the violent approach. And I say in the nonviolent, one trusts everyone in the beginning until there is solid ground for mistrust. And there is, there are people that after a while you will mistrust. I don't know that I would ever give up on them. And this is very relevant for the way you deal with your kids. I mean, there's very violent ways of dealing with kids. One mistrusts their motives and what they will do and why they're doing what they're doing all the time. And sometimes, you find out that there is some ground for mistrust. But there's a difference between these two types of persons, I think. Some people just mistrust from the beginning. And I hear that all the time in the way people talk about things. In fact, and this mistrust really creates all kinds of problems. The other day we were negotiating or reviewing one of our covenants with Kentucky Fried and Hubline. They were together, and so we had one covenant with both companies, Kentucky Fried Chicken. And after it, the person from Kentucky Fried said, "I'm not coming back again." He wasn't coming back because he was mistrusted, his motives mistrusted, it was asserted that he wasn't doing enough in his job, that he was simply filling the slot. And of course, you can make some judgments about that. But the whole way of dealing with a person, to run them into the ground, to see the negative parts of a person. Some people can never praise anybody. I don't understand it. Thomas Merton says that hell is a condition in which the only thing that you have in common with anybody is that you hate them, and where you hate yourself. And I think we probably all have a little bit of hell in us. A little bit. I mean, envy is really hate, I think. I mean, when you get satisfaction out of somebody else's failure, I think it's a sign of some deep lack of sense of identification with somebody else. At any rate, in the violent approach, one begins with the assumption that we are isolated individuals or unrelated social units, so that if I win, you lose. And you can take that up to the corporate level. If one corporation wins, another loses. If one person wins, another loses. If you win, I lose. If I win, you lose. We're all against all. We're in a battle of all against all, as Thomas Hobbes said. All we have are individuals seeking their own power. And if one gets power, the other doesn't get it. And it's power over. It's not a kind of shared power. It isn't power conceived of as something you can share. You either have it and control other people, because everything is thought of as external power, control over. Now, in the nonviolent approach, one begins with the assumption that we are parts of each other. Very interesting to read Gandhi on this point, that we are parts of each other. Gandhi considered himself part of India. India, somehow he was just identified himself with all of India. And now, actually, I think he actually identified himself with all of the world. He didn't hate the British. He didn't hate the rulers who were down there. He didn't like what they did, but he didn't hate them. He considered that they were human beings, that somehow they were part of humanity, and he was part of humanity. And I assume, based upon the image in 1 Corinthians 12, that we are all parts of the body of Christ, certainly in the church, and I consider the image of the body of church as a kind of analogy to creation. In creation, under God, we're all parts of each other. Through and in God, we are all parts of each other. So it isn't a question if you lose, I lose. It is a question, I mean, if you lose, I lose. If you win, I win. So it isn't this dichotomy between I win, you lose, or you win, I lose. You try to create a win-win situation. Well, I really believe in that image, although it's difficult to take such an organic image and make sense out of it. It's there in the Bible, and I believe it. I believe if you lose, I lose. If the Nicaraguans lose, I lose. If the Afghanistans lose, I lose. Part of my being is, when people are killed, part of my being is destroyed. I believe it. And I think if you believe it, you take this nonviolent approach. Now, it isn't that nonviolent people are passive. And I have here King's analysis of this. Love is not something sentimental and affectionate. I mean, it isn't just sentimental emotion. Love has a structure to it. Love, it makes great demands. But King says that Love means understanding, redeeming goodwill for all, so that it's an effort in love to bring about conditions so everybody wins. Love is not then aggressive physically toward one's opponent, although I think there are conditions when one has to use force, but generally speaking, one's mind and emotions are very active. I'm a very active person. I push Ford Motor Company into doing something. And we're pushing CBS. We have a boycott on CBS in Chicago and around the country, Los Angeles and New York and Philadelphia. I believe in pushing them into getting some black faces on their anchors. When we started this, I don't think there was a black anchor on the major time slot in the United States. And now they're beginning to have. So I believe in pushing people. You're aggressive with your spirit, and you're willing to act against people, and you are very active against people who seem to into institutions. But it's more active not in terms of trying to destroy even the institutions. You're not trying to destroy them. You're just simply trying to set up the conditions where it's desirable for them to change the behavior. I don't have any antagonism toward people who discriminate against black people. I just think we have to set up the conditions whereby whatever motivation they have, and what little care or what great care and love they have, you let it come out. I remember when we were negotiating with Jewel T, and the president of Jewel T said he flew back to Chicago to negotiate with us. And he said, I flew back because I'm a layman in a church, and I wanted to come back and do justice. Well, Jesse looked at me and winked, and of course we knew that he had some good motivation. We always assumed that people have good motivation, but we also knew he was threatened with our withdrawing our buying, and so it was a combination. The threat to withdraw our buying from Jewel T stores was a way of giving him the power to function in his corporation, we said, to do what he wanted to do. But he had a board of directors, and he had all kinds of problems. He had to make money, and he had to think about all of that. And while I don't think it cost Jewel a great deal of money to go out and find managers, and it cost them something, but it cost them executive time and energy to change their behavior, and so it became more profitable. So there's a sense in which our nonviolent action appeals to some of the motives that you might put on the violent side, that is to make money and to advance your own business and so forth. It also appeals to the goodwill. It assumes that a person of goodwill, when given some other motivation, the two motivations will succeed. President of Ford Motor Company came in to talk to us the other day, and he said, I believe in this, I'm gonna make it work. Now, a violent person would have said, that's hogwash. I said, I take him at his face, at his word, and I believe he will. The theory of nonviolence, my theory of nonviolence says, I'll get further. I'll get more done. I have enough experience with our other covenants to know if the president is not for it, it doesn't work. It works to a certain degree, but everybody testifies. If the president is for it and believes in it, it will work. Well, there probably are some presidents who don't believe in it, in this kind of affirmative action economic development program. But where you get one, and I believe you ought to assume that people will make it work from the very beginning, and you ought to give them a chance. And you ought to actually appeal to their deeper beings so that there might actually be a kind of redemptive process involved in terms of their own assumptions about life and the way they act. But where you have a confrontational style and where you use violence, there's no possibility. All you do is build up antagonisms, in my experience. At any rate, King says you do not attempt to defeat the opponent or humiliate the opponent. You seek to win friendship and understanding. One protests through non-cooperation or boycotts, but you are protesting the action. You're not assuming the evilness of the person. You're not trying to destroy the person. You're not trying to destroy his operation. You're trying to bring him into a more creative way of dealing with things that you think are involved with justice and love. It says the aftermath of nonviolence is creation of the beloved community. The aftermath of violence is tragic bitterness. You attack the forces of evil rather than against the persons. You avoid the internal violence of the spirit. The principle of love is the center. Now, it's very hard not to be vindictive and to practice this, but it seems to me that our Christian faith helps us with this. Although in the Bible study this morning, maybe many of you were as involved as I was with this kind of movement in God from destroying those who are unfaithful and forgiving them. And my conclusion after thinking about the Bible was that God does have the same kind of struggle that we have in terms of whether that destructiveness is the way to go or mercy. And I think we're faced with a decision in all kinds of situations as to whether we take the violent approach or the nonviolent approach. And I don't know how, if you are violent, where violence comes out, I'm not quite sure, except through a kind of conversion, a reconversion, a rebirth, that's a gift of God and not something you do. I guess at certain points psychotherapy might help one with the violence. I think I don't get angry, and I don't know why I don't get angry. You could say, well, because you're such a passive person, and the psychiatrist might say, well, you ought to get rid of your anger. You ought to get it out. You got it down there somewhere. I get sad. I really get sad. I frequently go home from a day's work and I'm sad because of the kind of violence I experience. And I think that's a pretty good way. One has to respond in some way or other. I agree, you can't just submerge it. Well, perhaps that's enough to get the discussion going. I have another whole piece here on what this would mean in terms of our relation to the USSR, because I think that's a fundamental problem, and I've tried to use this a little in understanding our leadership, but I think we'll open it up now, and perhaps that's a subject for next week. Go ahead, Doris.
I don't think we start too early to teach our children to think in nonviolent terms. I think a lot of times we underestimate their ability to be nonviolent. You know, our little 2-year-old grandson went in nursery school, and a little girl stood there with 2 horses, and he went up and took one, and she hit him. And he said, no, no, don't hit. Give me a hug. Not a 2-year-old could do that.
I meant to say that one of the criticisms of this approach is it only happens within a certain kind of a culture. Or it only happens in relation to places where you have law or something like that, which you can appeal to. But where it's only kind of naked struggle and without laws that you can appeal to, that it doesn't work, and I'm very much aware of that that problem. Ron?
Question about boycotts not being violent. Now, maybe it's because of where I live, but I'm in Seattle, Cone area, the history of the longshore workers merging up there in San Francisco. In Everett, we have tradition there of eight union workers were lined up by the corporations and shot through the head. And in Centralia, south of us, back in the 30s, the same thing happened. And, it just seems to me that a boycott, you say you're not attacking the person, you're attacking behavior and trying to provide them a more creative opportunity in which to deal with problems. But you jeopardize somebody's property, their possessions, and they take that as an attack on themselves. And maybe that's why so often in boycotts, violence does erupt. I don't know, could you say a little more about that?
Yeah, well, I'm very much aware of that issue that you say you don't attack property or life, but if you take away income, you are attacking their income, and that's the equivalent of property. It's a real pressure. And there's certainly been a lot of violence around boycotts. The question is, of course, how you respond to the violence. There was a great deal of violence in the South with the sit-ins and with all of that. And King believed, and evidently he was able to succeed in convincing a lot of people not to respond to that violence. When we were marching in the southwest side of Chicago, it wasn't a lot of violence. It was just broken bottles and stones and firecrackers and all that kind of stuff that were hurled at us. Probably weren't threatened a lot by your life, but you know, in terms of your life, but it was very kind of menacing. And
you really distinguish between coercion and violence. I think that's what he's talking about. Strikes and boycotts are coercion. Are they not, in a sense, violence?
Yeah. Well, I guess I believe in coercion. That is to say, I think you have to put certain people in prisons. I don't think you can get rid of external principles of control, but the question is whether in the process of doing that you seek to destroy the person. And I can't absolutize. All I can say is that in my experiences, and I think it would be worth trying in relation to Russia, to try a nonviolent approach. That is to say, to try a lot of the stuff that's in this this analysis of nonviolence with them. I think it'd be very creative, as over against the approach we're using right now. And that doesn't say we wouldn't have armaments. It doesn't say that we wouldn't be able to use them. But I don't know whether I've answered or even responded at all to what you said, Ron.
Have you taken your approach and looked at a past history situation and applied it, knowing what happened? Like the one we always think about is World War II with Hitler and what he did. Have you taken your ideas and done what if? Would any of those ideas have helped to stop that kind of madman aggression?
Well, sure. I mean, if somebody had made an analysis early on and the churches had responded with a non-cooperative approach to Hitler's program, you can't tell what would have happened. But it would require a decision. You have to make a decision about what justice is and about what is human. And then you have to have some ground for your action that's rooted in something that's important other than just your own power. And then you make a decision, then you act. So it requires a lot of thinking, a lot of perception, a lot of attention, a lot of praying over what it is that is wrong in the situation that you think is unjust. That's why it seemed a lot easier and is a lot easier to take something like voting, denial of voting rights, and say it's unjust. If you don't give people an opportunity to vote, it's unconstitutional, it's unjust. But when you get into the realm of economic organization, it's much more complex, much more difficult to say what is just and what is unjust. So it's much harder to make your judgments and to get results, because I think people generally will agree that people ought to have a right to vote. So the problem, therefore, is to educate and to expose and to appeal to a general ethos of thinking that everybody should have a right to vote. But where you don't have that general ethos, you have much more of a problem to appeal to. You see, this appeals to the goodwill and the kind of humanness of people. It assumes it's there. And in some situations, you just get such a variety of opinions that you don't have anything to appeal to. And the job of education then is much greater, much greater. We spend a lot of our time educating about the fact that CBS doesn't have much black presence. And yet its audience is somewhere, the new general manager of the Chicago station agrees that its audience is 20%. We're pushing for 27% on the basis of very careful analysis of the polls and of the studies and of the indices. But and you can't use quotas exactly, but what does fairness mean? Well, they agree that fairness would mean much more presence than they've got in terms of the audience that supplies them with the audience, which gives them their advertising dollars. So fairness would require that they put some of that money back into the audience, which gives them the basis for their profit. But it's not easy.
I'm just curious to know, if you see a difference in the way that you would approach individuals and the way that you would approach large groups, I'm sort of curious to know what you would say about our relationship with USSR. One of the major analysis of that is Reinhold Niebuhr, who talks about the difference in individual resources and group resources.
Yeah, moral man, immoral society.
Right, and you cannot respond. You cannot approach an individual the same way you can groups, because groups are going to lose that sense of the humanity and the sense of the value and ethics.
His point was, though, it's easier to be immoral as an officer of a corporation than it is as an individual. That was his point.
Right.
Yeah. So that it's easier to be immoral, because you can justify it in terms of the good of the corporation. But I don't think that has anything to do, really, with the issue of whether or not behavior can be changed if you can educate people as to the immorality of their existence. He was talking about the rationalization for the lack of morality. And I was talking about that the day before yesterday when I said what we do is to justify our selfish ends because we believe the interaction of selfish ends will bring about the good. So we justify them that way. But I don't think that if it results in destructiveness, then one has to find a way for overcoming that destructiveness. And I think same principles would apply to a corporation as to an individual. And all I can say is that your child, probably, if he were, to the extent that he understands this, and many of them do, will negotiate with you in terms of asking you to think of them and be fair to them and take them into account. And they will use the equivalent of a boycott to get it, or your spouse. At least that's my experience. And I welcome it because, you see, from my point of view, I'm limited in my perception of what I do. My wife and I have quite different perceptions of how much time I spend with my son and how much attention I give to the household and all these things. She has different perceptions from what I have. And if I don't understand my own complicity in believing I'm virtuous and have all the knowledge, that I'm not willing to listen to that and have a kind of negotiation and corporate discussion of what the truth is. And I find, as you may find, that once you open yourself up to the fact that you may not be right, other persons may do the same. And both your perceptions then shift. Now that's the theory of nonviolence, from my perspective. That's my theory. I'm not saying this is what anybody else says or anything else.
It occurred to me that would be good premarital counseling for your list of things about how to get along.
Oh, it is. I gave this to my community, and some of my community members put it up on their refrigerators. You know, I suspect, however, that human nature being what it is, that the people who felt the spouse was the one who was violent put up the list.
I should assume the best, Al.
That's right. I should assume the best, but I don't always do it.
I very much agree with what you're saying, but aren't boycotts really a way of changing behavior in order to change attitude? In other words, I don't think ways change attitudes first. Your approach, I understand what you're saying, that boycotts approached in a certain way are still engaging people with the same kind of nonviolent attitude you're talking about, and I agree with that. But it's a matter of saying that at some point, the example of Martin Luther King in the South, I think, is a real good one, where you create changes in behavior that are coerced, not because their attitudes have changed, and it's because then the structures and people's behavior changes, then the attitudes then start to change too. So you have both going on at the same time.
There's been a lot of social science research on that. I believe the research, which says you go both ways.
Right. Okay.
That is that if you I've read stuff which says if you set up a building and you have it arranged a certain way, certain people will talk to each other, and if you have that building and you have the interaction of blacks and whites, things will occur. But I also know that when you get close to people, you sometimes hate them. I mean, it's clear being interactive with people doesn't mean that's one of the things about a community is if you join the community, there are people, one of our members doesn't get along with anybody, including his wife. And I spend some of my time going into organizations where he is trying to mitigate that and trying to soften somehow what must be a very deep-seated mistrust of other people. I even got called from downtown the other day and said, will you do something about this guy? Because he's causing trouble in a community organization with which we have a relationship. Well, I think that there are social institutional arrangements which provide opportunities for people to grow, and their social institution arrangement at the same time, which provide opportunities for the worst in people to come out for all kinds of reasons. It's not easy to live with. It's not easy. It's almost impossible for me to live with these violent people. Let me put it that way. Almost impossible. Almost impossible. And Sarah will tell you, I come home some days and say, I'm going to quit. Why should I put up with this? Why should I go through all of this? It takes every bit of ounce of resource and prayer and discussion and everything for me to live with it. I'm not saying it's easy to be nonviolent. And King would certainly insist that they spend a lot of time in training. I don't know how much they spend in training. We certainly didn't spend a lot of time in Chicago in training in this nonviolent approach. We spent some, had training sessions.
Well,
I still got the problem, your problem, coercion. I say your question is still running by on the back of my mind.
It's been carried a little bit further by our conversation that people are coerced into some manner, their attitudes change after their behavior has changed. And after I left a session here an hour or so ago, a young woman, pastor, did an excellent job of a Bible study. And as I walked up the hill with somebody, I said, just think, 20 or 30 years ago, we wouldn't have had people like that. And I think lots of people who had reservations about women pastors 20 years ago, or even more recently than that, have changed their attitude because against their will, they've been dragged, struggling and kicking for women pastors who've done excellent jobs. And a change of their behavior, at least to the extent of having listened to a woman pastor or two or three or four, has changed their attitude. They've proved it works. Maybe our attitude started the blacks. We've found out that they can do things that we didn't think they could do. And you talk about we, the collective society.
Yeah, well, I'm not one who idolizes the principle of internal principle of motion or self-motion. To be good, one has to do something because one has chosen to do it. And an external principle of motion is destructive. I think it's the heart of the American political philosophy in most places to believe that if you do something that's your own choice, it's good. Almost it's good because it was your own choice. I don't believe that. And I don't believe to be coerced or even, to use a milder term, to be enticed or socialized into or organized into a principle of taking the group decision and following it or taking a government decision and following it is necessarily bad. In other words, I think the important point is what happens to you, not whether you... It's good if you decide to love God or to seek the good and the true, and that you're going to choose the good and the true regardless of how you feel about it. I think that, you know, it's good if you choose to do that, but I think there's certain values in a culture being forced to treat everybody as a human being. It's forced by external. It's good that we had affirmative action programs. It was creative and helpful. And so I'm not against that kind of coercion, but I'm against it, I think, from this point of view of the analysis, where you seek to destroy other people and degrade them and call them thugs if they don't agree with you, or they're different, or call them all kinds of words that are used to destroy people who disagree with you.
Well, that's the internal motion again, then, what your intentions are. That made it, I think in my experience in boycott and my hatred that I saw from the owners of the institutions, I say, well, my intention, I'm not in this for hate, I'm in it to try to help people, you know. And those grocery store owners in the lettuce boycotts in the 60s, man, they were mad. Madder than hell. I say, well, that, you know, they say, look what you're doing. I said, yeah, I'm not doing that. That's the way they reacted to the boycott. And then I was accused of being naive that a single action can't have more than one effect. There's multiple effects to an action. And if you're going to risk that action, you got to take the heat for those effects.
Oh,
you
yeah.
Just can't say, hey, that's not me. That's the way they reacted. Well, geez, if I wasn't telling everybody to quit buying their lettuce, you know, even though I don't want to hate, I'm not into hate the owner of the you know, hating a situation or not happy with the depression or whatever. But that draws it out. It draws out. Didn't King one time say that the nonviolent method does draw out hatred and violence? It draws it out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
to me seems violent.
It exposes it. It exposes it so you can deal with it. I think we need to close so that you can feel comfortable about getting to lunch. And I'll be here, but let us close with a prayer. If you may, and any of you would like to share in lifting this up to the glory of God and lifting all of us up, please feel free to. Oh God, we pray that you will be in and through, underneath, above, beneath, challenging us, chastening us, the way Kierkegaard is chastening us these days, and helping us, receiving us in our efforts to be faithful. Whatever they be, whatever directions they go, we may listen to each other and be drawn into thy life and the life of thy body. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.